Welcome to the second episode of Core Ideas, a paleolimnology podcast. I'm your host, or one of your hosts, Adam Jaziorski, and with me, as always, is...
Josh Thienpont. Welcome. Thanks for coming back.
And today, what are we talking about?
We are talking about bioindicators.
All right, you had me at bioindicator. So, just for general background, because we're obviously paleo people that are very familiar with this term, but what would you use for a rough definition of the term?
Again, it... Just like you started the last one, asking me to define paleolimnology, what is it with these questions to start off, throwing it to Josh to define things? That's a tough one, right? There's so much stuff in the sediment. You can find all sorts of different things. We've got the chemical, the physical, the biological. So we're obviously into the realm of biological remains of organisms that existed in the lake or in the catchment around the lake and left some sort of material behind. But I think a key part of the indicator part is that they are indicative of conditions in their environment.
Sounds good to me. So yeah, so the idea of where these things are become useful is due to the fact that environmental concerns usually only arise after a problem has been recognized. And so there is often no direct monitoring performed. So by using the sediments and the remains of little animals and plants that preserve in the sediments that accumulate 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, there's an archival record that you can visit back, going back as far as you need, depending on the thing that you're interested in. And one of the, what I've always thought is one of the cool things about, again, paleo, this is more paleo in general, but applies to new bioindicators as they're developed, is the indirect nature is you can always revisit old sediments and old cores with new techniques to perform reanalysis as things are developed.
For sure. You never know when you're taking a sediment core how far into the future that mud will be used for all sorts of different analyses to pull out different indicators, apply things that hadn't been invented or hadn't been really well defined or identified in order to say something about that environment. And then thinking about going forward continuing on from my very rough definition, the idea that there's all sorts of stuff in the mud, but one of the key things is obviously this preservation component that you mentioned, but then the other thing that can be really helpful is their distribution and how widely distributed they are. Something that's incredibly narrow in its range environmentally in a given location may not be the best bioindicator, though it can tell you something about the more unique aspects of that habitat, but may not be as broadly applicable as some of the others.
Exactly. And yeah, and then going along characteristics, another key one is a rapid reproductive response or rate, so they can respond quickly to environmental change. So the idea being that something as big as fish that has a life cycle of years is not going to show you a response anywhere as quick as something that is microscopic and potentially sure. Going through multiple, if not many generations during a single growing season.
Yeah, the leatherback turtle is not an amazing bioindicator for that exact reason.
Exactly. And and then also the smaller you go, the more abundant that their remains are likely to be, so that you can find lots of them to work with. Because again, and this comes into, quote unquote rules of what makes a good indicator, but that abundancy is often needed in order to get a decent assessment. So you're not working with just one or two individuals and trying to say this is what a certain area was like in a certain period of time.
Yeah, when
every does happen.
Yeah, for sure. When sometimes every gram of mud is, you know, costing hundreds or thousands of dollars to procure, if you have to go through 5-6 grams of wet weight in order to find the number of indicators that makes it kind of statistically relevant, then maybe that's not the best option. Whereas it's always, whatever is it we say, the amount of sediment on the head of a pin is enough to get hundreds of diatoms, which we'll talk about in a second. So there's a cost benefit analysis to be had for how useful it is and how applicable they are and what they can tell you versus how much effort both in the field, and then also in the lab, it takes to come up with reliable information from those indicators.
And then the next key one is that you're able to identify them, that they're taxonomically diagnostic. And this is what makes paleo such a slow analysis so much of the time, is usually you have to spend a lot of time looking through a microscope, looking at keys, looking at lots and lots of identification guides and pictures to really learn what those individual varieties of diatoms are, or
what their name is this week.
I've never actually really had to deal with that, being more of a invertebrate guy, but still.
Well, we learn things all the time and we readjust where things fit in the tree of life. And that's part of understanding that group or those groups.
And then finally, once you've found lots of your organism of choice, you have lots of identified remains. Next thing is that you need to have a well-defined idea of their optimum tolerances, or like what kind of environmental conditions that they prefer and are most commonly found in.
Yeah, and that's a hard one. That's written down here as we were thinking about what to say, is that that's the one that gets bent the most. None of these environments are univariate. There's lots of different variables that are changing in different gradients in terms of the water temperature, the pH, the salinity of the water, the light availability, the biological interactions. So there are all sorts of different things that are going together, and being able to pull apart those potential drivers and where those species fall along those environmental gradients is really, really challenging. Doesn't mean that they're not incredibly useful, but it means that you have to think about what's going on in that lake as you're trying to calibrate them, whether statistically or just in your own mind, to the condition you're interested in.
Yeah, and one of the things that of the many things that I think has been cool about paleo, is the whole idea that there are subsets of these remains that have well-defined optimum tolerances due to spatial analyses, but not necessarily a strong idea of what organism that they're related to. In not real life, but for example, chronomid larvae, like the larvae, in some cases have been identified as the larvae, but it's not entirely sure which adult species corresponds sure. to the larvae.
Yeah, chrysoprase cysts are an example. They're numbered. There's no species identification on them. Yeah, for sure. We know something about the environment of chrysoprase cyst 31F or whatever. I don't know if that's an actual one, but nothing to do with which species, living species that identifies with. So, but that doesn't mean they're not useful. And if we find species 31F, yeah, exactly.
It's kind of
that you can do things without the perfect name associated with them. And there's always potential for that to become the name at some point when you figure out what that species is.
Yeah, but just in the meantime, it's like this scale, we don't know where it comes from. But when we do find it,
this is the condition. Yeah, exactly. For sure. Utility, but still some holes, some gaps in the knowledge there. And then the only thing I guess that we didn't say is that what makes you decide which bioindicator you're going to spend your time during this chapter of your master's degree or this first section of your PhD focusing on? What is it that makes you decide that, hey, I think this environmental question is really well tuned to using Cladocera as the bioindicator, as at least the primary bioindicator, and that really the question can in many ways drive what it is you decide to put that effort towards.
Yeah, no, definitely tailoring your indicator towards the environmental question you're trying to address. And all these indicators have like a developed literature and methodology for looking at different things, and that's why the world did not begin and end with diatom analyses or pollen analyses. More techniques were developed to answer a broader suite of questions. What kinds of bioindicators are out there? Personally, for what it's worth, this is my show, so I can say what I think. But when I'm thinking of bioindicators, I definitely think of the big three, which would be diatoms and chrysophytes, kind of lumped together as siliceous algae. And then two groups of invertebrates, the cladocerans, which is the one that I cut my teeth in paleo on, And also in terms of invertebrates, chironomids, but then also lump chaeobrids in with them too. So, I don't know, should I give some background or would you like to talk a little bit about the diatoms and chrysophytes?
Whichever.
What they are?
Well, they're, yeah, with... Go and read the Wikipedia on there and see what it's on the golden brown algae or the heterokonts, and it probably will change while you are reading it because there's a lot of unknown and a lot of debate as to exactly where those species fall into the kingdom of, not kingdom in the true sense, but into all of the algae in the world. There's a lot of back and forth into the taxonomy of these groups. There's a lot of uncertainty, and that comes from just the fact that they've been studied for a long, long time and named a bunch of things over many years, and no one's really know exactly how well they are or how they're related to one another. In general, though, they are autotrophic organisms. They are in the group heterokont, which are these golden brown type of algae. Diatoms are the more abundant of the group, and they're a really important group in the marine environment as well. They, as a whole, produce something like 20% of the primary production on the planet, so they're incredibly important from a global production perspective. And the thing about them that makes them important for paleo, other than all those little facts I'm trying to draw up from the depths of my mind, is that they leave these preserved siliceous cell walls. So they're made of silica and biogenic silica that they secrete into their cell walls. And when they die and break apart in the sediments, that silica is left behind and it's taxonomically distinct. So if we're breaking the two groups down, we have the diatoms, as I said. We'll get maybe to them after. I'll talk very briefly about chrysophytes. Chrysophytes are another group. And we mentioned them earlier in that they can be broken down in the sediments into two basic remains that are found, the scales, and those only come from a couple of groups of the chrysophytes. So not all chrysophytes produce scales. And those that do are holoplanktonic. So they are a planktonic group living in the water column. But all chrysophytes do produce cysts. And that's their resting stage that would spend time in the sediment in order to overcome and to tolerate harsh conditions and then reemerge into the water column. So those are what we would find in the sediment. They're often used as indicators of pH changes in the lake, though there are other papers out there on different environmental conditions. And there's been a lot more recently on using the scaled chrysophytes as a climate indicator because when these planktonic groups, so as water conditions warm, stratification increases, and there's more thermal stability, greater stratification, then we get more planktonic groups, which we see at the diatoms, but also with the scaled chrysophytes. So an increase in scaled chrysophyte remains is a common indicator of warming conditions. So that would be the chrysophytes.
So I think of you as, within the paleo realm, as a diatomist. Have you done... any other proxies yourself or any other bioindicators yourself? Or
beyond
is that
diatoms?
Your bread and butter?
By and far, bread and butter. I've done some cladocera work personally and then had some students work on other things. But no, personally, sitting at the scope, I've looked at diatoms, other things that are on the diatom slides, so other siliceous stuff, but mostly just enumerating or counting those, and then cladocera.
So yeah, so cladocera would be my, I guess... Now it's my focus is kind of split, but was my original indicator. Although I did begin with diatoms.
I knew so that. Done exactly I remember that. Yeah.
Diatom count in my life as part of my undergrad thesis.
So we never really talked about diatoms. So what? Very briefly, then. What was that? What were you doing with diatoms in that project? I've forrotten. That was from the PAD, wasn't it? The Peace Athabasca Delta.
No, it's pre-PAD.
Pre-PAD.
Yeah, it was with Roland Hall when he was a very new professor at the University of Waterloo. And he'd come over from Sweden and had a core from the Abisko region.
Right, right, okay.
And it was looking at tree line migration in a high altitude lake with the idea that there was a multi-proxy study. They were looking at other things, but they were interested in the diatoms to see. They knew the tree line had moved above and below
right.
the lake over the last 10,000 years through the Holocene kind of period, I think. This is going back. I've not looked at that paper in a long time. And yeah, and I was tracking the diatom changes.
Well, that's the thing with diatoms being so many, it's like being such a species group that they can be used and have been used for almost every kind of environmental reconstruction, whether it's pH, salinity, light availability, water temperature, you name it, you can probably find it in the diatom literature. So they're one of those groups that can be used for a lot of things, for good or for evil. Cool. So moving on to the, so we've done algae. There are some obviously other algae that remain in the sediments. And we'll talk to that in the sort of grab bag after the big three. Moving on to the cladocera, where you, as you say, cut your teeth. Tell us about the cladocerans.
Okay. So cladocerans are a group of the zooplankton. And we're getting a bit bigger than diatoms. You can make out some of the features barely on some of the cladocerans just with your naked eye. So if you were to take a glass jar of lake water, you definitely see some little things bobbing around in there, some microscopic organisms. And chances are some of those are going to be members of the cladocera. And by and large, for the most part, these are grazers. So they're chowing down on algae like the diatoms. And there's a couple of predatory types. But what makes these guys a fair bit different than the diatoms is that instead of whole individuals preserving the sediments, because we're going up a notch in size, these guys break down into separate parts like head shields and carapaces and post abdomens and whatnot. And so has its own identification challenges because you're never dealing with whole organisms. But anyway, these guys can be used to look at changes in predation trends over time, because you'll see things changing in the size structure or the species structure in relation to whether or not they're being there's like fish pressure on with like large fish populations chowing down on them. Some association with nutrient conditions and acid conditions, but what my main focus was in their responses to calcium decline, which in itself is a legacy of acid rain, with some of these guys quite calcium demanding relative to their peers, and as such able to leave behind a legacy of recovery from acid rain. So that'd be the cladocerans. And then rounding out the big three, also another invertebrate group that I've done a fair bit of work with is the chironomids, and then air quotes, and the chaeobrids, which is a different group, but similar to the diatoms and chrysophytes, are often analyzed together. But the chironomids are a common to anyone that lives near me in Kingston in the springtime.
Yeah, here down too. By the water. Yeah, we get tons of them here on Lake Scugog. Yep. So non-biting midges, so they're a true fly.
And the big swarms you have down by the water in spring, a lot of people often will refer to them as mayflies, which is totally incorrect because they're a separate thing, but just they'll call them that based on the time of year that they seem to pop out in like late April, early May.
Yeah, thank God, because there are lots of mayflies, not so much here, but in Lake Simcoe is notorious for having tons of mayflies, and they're so much bigger than chironomids.
Thousands of times bigger.
Oh, for sure. In Beaverton, which is right on the shore of Lake Simcoe, the buildings look rough. Like you could imagine they're shaggy from all the mayflies that are on the side of them. If that was how many chironomids there were, oh my God, people would never walk down by Lake Ontario or any of the Great Lakes. Anyway, sorry, I digress.
Yeah. No, it's the old apartment building just in the doorwells to the main entrance at the back just because of the light that was there.
Oh, yeah.
And you'd get like huge piles of dead chironomids. Or
Adam and I used to do this run at the move-out weekend, so right at the end of April in Kingston every year. And it was like you were taking in your protein while you were running along the waterfront for this 10K run because of all the chironomids. So they are abundant in aquatic ecosystems.
And that is so gross. And I don't know why we continue to subject ourselves to that.
4 years in a row we did that.
Yeah. Dumb.
Yep.
Dumb.
That's good exercise.
But anyway, the chironomids their use, they're benthic dwelling organisms, and so their main use that they're used for is tracking changes in oxygen conditions in the hypoalbumin of lakes. And so this really gets at where different, or as an example of different bioindicators being useful for different things, because by and large, the diatoms are photosynthetic. They require to be in the light to survive. So they're not going to give you much information about what's going on at the bottom of the lake, where it's completely black and frigid. Whereas the chironomids, the opposite of that, you know, they spend most of their time in the water, some of them down deep, some of them less so, but basically only come up to the surface to emerge.
Some people might be familiar with the chironomids from certain species that are that bright red color, the bloodworms that I think people keep them to or buy them to feed to their fish in their fish tanks, things like that.
I did that historically as a kid.
Oh, really? I've seen pictures of them. Based on the name
and then found out much later that they were actually chironomids.
Not worms at all, yeah. And then the last thing being the chaoborids, which are the phantom midges, is their kind of colloquial name for them. And they're a really interesting group. I've spent a very little time looking for them under the microscope for one particular project. But the idea that they're a much less species-rich group, there's only a few species that are commonly found in sediments. And the key thing that they are used for is to track and infer, estimate, whether the lake has fish in it, because certain species are big and they're all quite big. You can easily see them with the naked eye, but certain species are big and easy prey for fish, for planktivorous fish that eat the plankton, to pick out of the water column, because they don't migrate down to the bottom. So the visually hunting planktivorous fish will be able to easily eat away these species during the day, whereas the other species will sink down to the bottom and then only come out at night to undergo their majority of their activities. So if you find these species that are not migrating, vertical migrators, they are going to be the ones that don't coexist with fish. So finding them would suggest that the lake, at least in the habitat where you find the chaoborids, is probably fishless or has very low fish abundance.
And one last thing to point out there is we've definitely gone up size gradient talking about our personal big three organisms, with the diatoms being truly microscopic, the cladocerans being, you know, you can make them out visibly, and then chironomids, like individual bloodworms, like no problem making them out
naked eye. In the centimeters, some of them can be.
Yeah.
And chiaobras, massive.
And that's what I was going to get at. So then I didn't really say, but the chironomids, in terms of what preserves in sediments, you're dealing with like their head capsules. So only their head is chitinized, and that's the bit that remains. And then when you get to the chaoborids, you're dealing with just individual mandibles. So just like part of their
feeding their jaws.
Jaw apparatus. And those would be like the size of the whole head of some of the chironomids.
It's amazing that you get bigger and bigger and bigger whole organisms and a smaller proportion of them preserve in the sediments.
Well, I guess, you know, it'd be tough being a big thing made of glass.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. Though there are some big diatoms. The, what's it called? The one.
Didymo.
Didymo, yeah. Found.
I don't know what the full name is.
Me neither. Can't remember. But a very large diatom species. But by and large, they're much smaller than that. Cool. So that is the big three, at least from our background. When we were talking about this, we said that that's probably not true, and that if you were to pick the historically biggest paleo indicator, pollen would have to be a good candidate for one of the most common, earliest used indicators in lake sediments. But
absolutely, but this is our podcast.
I'm not saying that we can't do what we want.
And so we can deal with pushback. But going forward, I think pollen is something I've never personally really worked with. We can lump in with other bioindicators that, you know, we know something about.
Yeah, for sure. But if you're saying, no, chaoborids aren't the big three indicators, we understand. But this is from our perspective. And the nice thing that I think ties all of them together is that they are autochthonous. They are in the lake itself. So they're telling you about conditions in the lake environment. Whereas when you get to some of the other commonly used indicators, but maybe not the most commonly used ones that we mentioned already, they can be coming into the lake from outside outside of the lake ecosystem itself. And that can be a really important distinction for picking out the different indicators. So there's a bit of method to the madness of separating them out that way.
Okay. So in terms of like the other guys, we mentioned pollen. So that's pollen coming from the vegetation surrounding a lake, giving you some idea of what's going on a terrestrial level. So that is very well studied. Then we're getting in, there's other things such as, and I guess in a similar vein, plant macrofossils. So chunks of other kinds of plants.
Yeah. Everything else from plants that isn't pollen that can end up in the sediments, twigs and branches and all sorts of stuff. There's lots of people who are really, really interested in that as a way of giving you really diagnostic stuff about the species that it came from. And also because pollen travels so far on the wind that these larger macrofossils give you a better indication of the environment right around the lake than the pollen is, which is more of a regional signal.
And then phytoliths, now this is one I'm much less familiar with, is from within grasses. It's a... What is it?
So phytoliths are interesting in that they're also found on, it's made of silica, biogenic silica. So you would see them occasionally on diatom slides, depending on where, or on diatom and chrysophyte slides, depending on where they are from. But it is the extracellular silica that's secreted into the space in between cells for a lot of different plant species, but it's very common in the grasses. So if you've ever taken a piece of grass as a kid and run it through your teeth or like you're trying to blow it like a reed, you would feel that it's that really rough texture to it. And that is the silica that's in between the thing. It gives it sort of structure without the formal structural material that higher woody plants and trees have to hold them up. And it also protects against pathogen attack into the different cells. So it provides some support and features to the plant, and the shape of the extracellular space can be diagnostic as well. It can tell you about the plant group that it came from.
And then keeping within the vegetative remains, another big one would be charcoal, which especially with what's going on in Australia right now is kind of top of mind. And because it is used often to track forest fires. And it's always blown my mind that it can be diagnostic to a particular fire event.
To some extent.
Based on shape and size.
Yeah, so there's a bit of a dichotomy with charcoal in that a lot of studies look at the total amount of charcoal, just the accumulation of all charcoal in the sediment of all sizes, usually macroscopic. So they're, from a method perspective, you bleach it or you treat it with some sort of chemical to change the color of everything in the sediment. And then you count it under a dissecting scope. So it's the largest particles. And those would give you an idea of, so there's always charcoal coming into the lake. But when you get these peaks, that would be associated with a fire. There's also some work that's been done, including at Queen's, on microscopic charcoal. So looking at the smaller pieces and how the different structural elements are associated with different types of fires and different severities of fires. And I'm not sure that it's taxonomically distinct as to the species it comes from, though, of course, if it's not completely combusted, you would be able to get the same macrofossil kind of information as you would from a normal macrofossil. But it can give you an idea of the fire environment and the transport environment, whether it's been weathered and reworked before it got to the lake.
Then, going further down the list of things that I have very little familiarity with, we have testate amoeba, which I personally associate with like peat kind of studies.
Yep.
I'm not sure where else they use or how well they preserve in
They're found in other environments, and these are amoeba, so single-celled organisms that create houses for themselves, and so they build these structures that they live in, and that's the test. And when they dissociate, you can either find the whole test and be able to see sort of which species group that came from, or you can find the plates themselves individually, so that just like the scales of a chrysophyte break apart, it's not the whole organism, you have individual scales, you can find the plates that originally made up the test that the amoeba produced for itself. But you're right that historically you find them associated with different pH environments, but also really important, the different, because they're amoeba, the different environments in terms of moisture availability. So you'll find ones that are more more commonly found in really wet environments and then drier environments. And so they're commonly used to track the movement between truly aquatic, semi-aquatic, kind of partial terrestrial environments.
Then on going down our list, we have ostracons, which again, I don't know how much I'm going to show again how much broader Josh's knowledge is than my own or how much better research he is, but I personally associate them with isotope studies, kind of getting outside of the, they're kind of a crossover in terms of bioindicator. I don't think of them too much as individual biological studies and more of them a source for grinding up for isotope analysis?
Yeah, they exist. They're more commonly found in the marine literature or in the brackish water literature. So looking at like coastal lagoons, that's not to say there aren't freshwater ostracots. That's certainly not the case, but they haven't been as well utilized for the kind of classical paleolimnological analyses, primarily because they would indicate the same kind of things that diatoms do. So diatoms have already filled that niche. Whereas in the marine kind of brackish realm, they're really important indicators of salinity, and you can get really good information on salinity environments, but they're bigger than the diatom. So while you can blast away at an individual or a kind of refined group of diatoms for isotopes, as Adam just said, an ostracot is bigger, so it's easier to be able to do that with a little more accuracy without needing as much pre-processing. So they are commonly used for their the composition, particularly the oxygen composition of their shells, I guess.
Okay. And that's beyond the scope of today's bioindicator analyses. We'll leave that for chemical indicator.
Yep.
Analyses another day.
Exactly.
Or physical indicator, I guess.
We need another whole episode to talk about just the isotopes almost.
But I think in my list, you know, going to have any pushback on the big three, what else would you add to our longer list there? I've kind of covered everything that I never really think about.
Yeah, I think so. There are a few other things that you see on slides that probably aren't, well, I mean, if I'm thinking like looking through, I know you can't see me because I have my eyes closed, so I'm like looking through a diatom slide, and the only other thing you might see are freshwater sponge spicules or things like that, but they're very poorly identified. Or abatid mites are found in
various other insect things. Remains.
Beetles will leave certain remains behind. I mean, it's not uncommon to find fish otoliths. So to say that all these things are invertebrate or algal would be not entirely true. They're very rare compared to diatoms or even cladocerans. But they do exist. You can find otoliths, inner ear bone, for lack of a better word, of fish in the sediments. I don't know. I think we're getting pretty close to the end of the commonly used. We're getting into some really esoteric stuff. We've probably forgot something really big.
Yeah. But anyway, the list is long enough. And so the idea is there's lots of stuff to choose from out there. And you tailor your method and your analysis to what you're looking at. Because obviously, as it kind of got in a little bit in the diatoms versus the chronomids, they live in different areas of the lake. Some of these guys live in the open waters, some of them in the sediments, different types of lakes. So they'll tell you different things about the environment, and what you look at really depends on what you're interested in. And if you're looking at a study looking into the acidification history of a lake, then probably chronomids is not going to be your first choice.
Yeah, or pollen's probably not where you're going on that one.
No, you're going to zoom in right on the diatoms. And conversely, if you're interested in changes in the tree line around the lake, then pollen would be your go-to. Or if you're interested in, you know, the calcium conditions in the lake, cladocerans,
yeah, or
oxygen,
the fish availability, or fish community, rather. Yeah, diatoms and chrysophytes are not going to be all that helpful there.
Yeah. And so this is why so often, you know, look in the literature and so many studies have multiple bioindicators in use, tracking their changes through time.
That has to be together. That has to be so much more common than it used to. I mean, I don't know that anyone's ever gone and looked at the number of indicators that are common in a sort of meta-analysis framework to look at papers from the 70s, the 60s, and see how many different things were identified in that paper. And I would bet, though, and I don't think it would be hard to imagine, that as we get to more common, more recent papers, papers with only one indicator in them have to becoming rarer in the literature. Because we live in a complicated world where there's lots of different things going on in the lake.
I probably actually an interesting thing to knock out, because like the flip side of that is looking at a core for a single organism and writing that up is so much easier than coordinating a multi-proxy analysis. So you've got this push-pull, like, yes, percentage-wise, it's probably way higher than it was historically, or there are more multi-proxy analyses than there were historically. Yeah. But has it changed historically just because there's more papers out there? That maybe it hasn't changed them. I'd actually be kind of, I'm not interested in doing that work, but I would actually be interested in seeing that work just to see from a the point of view of how has things changed over the last, I don't know, 30, 40 maybe years.
Yeah, I think you're right in that as a proportion, multi-proxy papers where more than one of these things is looked at would probably have been very rare 40 years ago. And now, as a proportion, they would be higher, but there are still lots and lots of uniproxy papers. Is that what you would say? One proxy papers out there. And
single proxy,
that makes more sense. And nothing against them. You don't have to have multiple proxies. If it's a story that is well told and it's simpler with one of them, then that works.
So the final thing I think we talk about today in our little exploration of bioindicators would be some of the more exotic stuff. And, you know, if I had a little familiarity with things like ostracods, now we're getting the region of stuff that I know the words and not too much more. But you definitely, again, breadth of knowledge is pretty good. Beginning even with sterols and stanols, you've done some of this stuff yourself.
Oh, that's right? Not true. I've been in the lab while someone has done that. So when I was at the University of Ottawa for a little while, they're a lab that's derived or that's centered more around chemical indicators in sediments. And one of the things that sort of came into the lab in terms of a method while I was there or just before I was there was the use of sterols and stanols. So these are chemical molecules that are, so not a biological remain in the same way as anything we've talked about before, but that are linked to the presence of organisms. And the most common sterol that everyone's familiar with is cholesterol, or cholesterol is how most people refer to it, which is produced by all animals. And so the presence of cholesterol in the sediment would indicate that animals had been in the catchment, and primarily the method for those to get into, so cholesterol is in all of our cell membranes. It provides structure to the cell membrane and it's an important biomolecule. But the primary way that they get out of the body is, unless you render a body down in the lake, is through the fecal matter. So they would indicate,
aka the poop.
In the poop. Yeah. So that would indicate that there had been animals living in the catchment. And while that is a sterol that is ubiquitous in animals, there are plant sterols, cetosterols, and there are sterols and stanols, which are another group of closely related molecules that are more indicative of different groups. So there may be higher mammal sterols that are only indicative of, at least in an environmental setting, unless there are apes in the catchment, which is very unlikely, of humans being in the environment. And that's commonly been used and becoming more commonly used for tracking historic indigenous groups, paleo Inuit and the precursors of the Inuit who have moved around the Arctic. There's some work on that. And then also used to track organisms like birds and their influence, because their abundance can produce a lot of poop, which can then be indicated in the sediment.
And we also have eDNA, which is basically a measurement of the DNA, raw DNA in the bulk sediment. So genetic information from everything you can possibly find, which strikes me as being incredibly difficult. A few conversations I've had with people that are working on this is just separating the signal from the noise, because so much stuff is present from so many different groups coming in from so many different avenues. But I think as computing power builds up and they're able to amplify stuff and separate and analyze this information, it's going to be a bigger and bigger thing going forward.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. And there's lots of ways you can go about doing that. I think some are, you're looking for very specific groups. So you have primers for their genetic sequence that you are tailored and you're searching out. But as we get better and better with our resolution of finding these things, it's more common to apply what would be considered a shotgun approach, where you just fire all of the information into a computer and start to just pull out everything that's there. So we did that a little bit in at Ottawa U with bacterial DNA work in order to see whether there were groups in particular we were interested that were capable of processing hydrocarbons. So we just put all this information from the sediment and also from the water into the pipeline effectively in order to see what was there and pick out the species that their genetic material was there. It doesn't really tell you if they're active, if they're upregulated, but they do give you an idea that there's the presence of their genetics in that environment.
And I guess one of the big things, I guess holding it back, but as time ticks forward, to be the libraries that this information is measured against. So the more of these studies that are done, the more complete the libraries that you're able to test your own sample against become. So it's just a matter of time. Like, it might be a long time, but eventually you get it. Like, there's a massive future.
Yeah, the more targeted studies and laboratory studies that give you that material to compare against, the library allows those untargeted type of analyses to be much more powerful. That's always the problem, is identifying. It's not, especially for newer sediments, finding what's there. It's saying what the heck that corresponds to in the actual environment. The one thing about DNA that always is the main holdback is the preservation of DNA in the sediment environment. Sediments, especially for DNA that's not contained within the organism's remains still, that's free DNA, is a bit of a challenging place. And they're getting much better at fixing those holes and pulling those things out, but there still is a temporal constraint on how long things like that can preserve, at least for now.
Do you have any sense of, like, again, I'm so far out of my wheelhouse now, both the eDNA, like, is there any such thing as a Holocene eDNA study, or is there a like hard cap on time for how long it sticks around in the sediments?
I'm not sure I've ever seen one that long. I don't think I would be able to guess off the top of my head what the oldest one. I certainly have seen studies well into the 200 plus year range for viable DNA. Not viable as in you can create a dinosaur from it, but viable as in can be identified. And then what is the last thing on my list here is something that we've done a little bit of in the lab that my wife Jenny Carosi runs at York University is interested in, is plant lignin. So one of the interesting things about that we said earlier about pollen is that, you know, you get this huge regional signal and it's hard to say what was right around the lake. And then also one of the things about pollen is aquatic organisms don't produce a lot of pollen. Aquatic plants don't produce a lot of pollen compared to trees. So one of the things we can look at are molecules that are truly indicative of plants, things like lignin. So that's a molecule that's only produced in plants. And so the presence of these are truly indicative of higher plants in the catchment, not from algae. And closely related to that are alkanes. So alkanes, if you remember back to your chemistry, are, you know, long chains of hydrocarbons. And we call them N-alkanes, and the N just means how many there are. So the longer the chains, they tend to be associated with higher plants. So algae will produce short chain alkanes, and reeds and sedges and things that are kind of semi-aquatic will produce middle length ones. And then higher plants will produce really long ones. So you can look at the alkane chains in the sediment and they'll tell you about the plants and whether, so we use these to track lake expansion. So as a lake gets bigger, it floods the terrestrial environment. So there's going to be a greater proportion of incoming material to the sediment when those plants drowned and all of their alkanes entered into the lake. We would see that in the sediment record. That was my last one. And that I could think of as a link between living organisms and the chemistry.
Okay. And so, yeah, so I think we've gotten all the way through our list as our introduction to bioindicators, that stuff I know a lot of, some of it I know a lot about, some of it I know next to nothing about, but I think it's a pretty decent list. And a key takeaway is the biological remains are just one subset of the information preserved in sediments. There's a whole lot of physical and chemical information that we've not even touched on in this discussion. Now we can save for another day.
An interesting one for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. Because again, we'll talk about next time the information within the sediments that is used to date the sediments, which is often the linchpin that all these analyses are built in. Is it's one thing to know that species A changed to species B, which may or may not be interesting on its own, but it's critical to know when that happened if you're trying to tie it to a particular event around the lake, whether it's acid rain, a massive flood event, a mine, initial land clearance. And then if you don't have the dates, then, what are you really talking about?
Yeah, for sure. It's not always that you can independently identify the timing of those kinds of changes. Having a fixed chronology is a really key part to the power of paleolimnology.
Okay, so I think we're done with episode 2. And so as we move along with this podcast, we now have our very own website, which is basically been tacked onto my own, but it's can be found at coreideas, all one word, .ajeziorski.ca. You'll just have to Google it for now. And for contact us directly with questions or ideas for topics, or even hate mail, anything really, just prove that we're not talking just to ourselves. You can reach us at coreideaspodcast@gmail.com.
Yeah. Which indicators did we forget, or which ones do you want to hear more about? I'd be interested in researching some of the ones that we just completely glossed over or butchered, whichever it was. Hit us up with an email if something is interesting, or contact one of us directly.
All right. Until next time, this has been Core Ideas, and we hope to see you again soon.